Yes.
Oh, I see you there. Whoops.
All right. Well. That's good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Thomas over here at the GPS here in the chair. So let's go ahead and start off the roll call.
Chuck
sure,
sure.
Adams.
Oh, I think that's me. That's me.
No, that's not Carlos. Robert Arnold. Urban Barrios is absent. Leroy Blair.
Here.
Bill Bloom. Here. Anna Branzuela.
Here.
Franco Chevalier is on the lead of that. Ed Chitty.
Ed Chitty is here. Okay.
Zachary Davenport, I believe in that. Elaine Ford.
Present.
Elise Griffin. Jesus Lier.
Here.
Ron Hernandez.
Present.
Lee Jewell.
Present.
Thomas Noble.
Present.
Na Lee. PJ Liniaki is excused. Kellen Lynn, I believe in that. Derek Mack.
Here.
Marco Montenegro is excused. Jan Oskar. Irma Perot.
Here.
Charles Cerrone. J.D. Soto.
Here.
Richard Sullivan is on leave of that. Laura Thomas.
Here.
Manuel Vasquez.
Here.
All right, we have a forum. Mark Warren, Council Staff.
Here, Council Staff.
I'll be delivered to the public very much. Andy
Stone.
David Paul. Matt Corman, Steven Spahn,
Jordan Mullen, Molly Herzig.
CSN.
Here. I've just been doing my best there. Thanks for the assist.
Did we miss anybody?
Online, thank you. Mark, do you want to go? Go ahead and do a quick introduction online. Can you hear us, Marco?
He's done here. Marco, you're on juice.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Okay, there it goes.
Well,
oh, I am
Joseph? Uh,
Joseph, if you're speaking, we can't hear you. Kimberly? All right. All right, anybody else?
Do you have your mic as well?
Everyone's already. All right. Let's go ahead and approve the agenda for today's meeting. Please give a look. Let me know if there's any changes. No changes, approved by consensus. Go ahead and review the minutes from the last meeting, about 23rd. Corrections or changes? Seeing none, we will approve by consensus. Any announcements from council members?
Whatever the reporting, you know, nice to be here. And thank you for what many of you have done for all our communities. April 8th is the 10th anniversary of Last Man Standing. Last Man Standing is the first full film documentary done by the San Francisco Chronicle. So this about the Cherry Hunter survivors. Two of the men are gone by now, but it is very important to remember what the words Cherry Hunter survivors meant and mean, because it seems like the words had been almost erased. And I just want to remind you that by now, just the people born with HIV, they're thinking the word are calling themselves dandelions. And many of us are just calling ourselves the Phoenix generation. But I hope you see this documentary if you haven't seen it. Thank you.
Yes, I just wanted to apologize ahead of time. The last vote on motion.
Very nice. And,
I will also be fully grounded in that.
Yeah, that's
really good.
Great, thank you. Any other council members? I'll just acknowledge that Rich Sullivan is open to visits. So those of you who might be interested in reaching out to Rich, let me know.
Is public comment or announcements?
I was going to get public comments, but you go for it, please.
Yeah, I know you all will be discussing and voting on budget issues tonight. I'd just like to remind everyone, not that everyone here doesn't know it already, but the city and county of San Francisco have a long tradition of backfilling federal cuts and Ryan-like funding. The mayor, before he was running for office, he pledged to continue that great tradition, and his budget did so last year. This year, as you probably all know, we were facing kind of more than $600,000 in Ryan-like federal funding. And through the advocacy of Laura, SFAS, and others, the state was going to be backfilling that money. So that does not have to come out of general funds this year, which is a wonderful, wonderful development. Thank you for those who made it possible. But as the city directs DPH to make funding cuts, it makes sense to me that we should be credited for that $600,000 plus, meaning that $600,000 that does not have to come out of the general fund. And therefore, that is your all's commitment towards savings. Everyone make sense? Does the math make sense to everyone? Okay, thank you.
Any other comments?
Just continuing off of the theme around the budget cuts. I mean, one thing that I want to lift up, I'm sure most folks in this room are aware, my name is Amy Stone. I work for the HIV Advocacy Network, directly community mobilization and policy at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. Just recently, the Department of Public Health identified about $17 million that would be cut in the budget. There's about $1.3 or $1.4 million of that that's targeted at HIV programs. We were able to successfully, as we mobilized and pushed back against those attempted cuts, to reclaim some of that funding for our programs. We are looking at replacing another $20 million plus another contingency beyond that. Cuts to CEOs, and I just wanted to highlight that this is a moment where we have to show up, we have to push back, we have to demand that our communities are supported, fully funded in the budget. We have been doing this work of making sure that there's other funding to be able to support our programs in the event of federal cuts, including at the state level. And we need our city leaders to step up and do what is necessary to protect our communities, as, for example, the mayor promised in his election speeches and during his campaign to run for mayor to support our programs around care and prevention. So we need to hold our elected officials accountable, and I highly encourage everyone to really step up in this moment and push back. When we show up and we fight back, we can reclaim this funding that works, it's effective. We have to demonstrate that we have the political will to stand up and demand this funding goes to our communities. We have had some conversations with some of the candidates who are running for different offices, and I think we're working with the HIV Providers Network also to do forums for candidates running for different levels. I think there's the congressional race, but there's also D8, there's also D10, there's also several other district supervisor races that are happening this year as well. So we'll continue to engage.
Thank you. And just as a matter of process, I appreciate that. We don't generally dialogue here for we're engaging with you as well, but the process serves a purpose. Any other comment before I want to make sure I don't miss staff announcements as well? Great. Do you have
anything else? I do. Just want to remind members of the public to sign on the The first one being, if you have not completed your 700 forms, let's do so. If that's approaching that April 1st deadline, please do that. And then the second reminder, just to fill out these evaluation forms, we do look at them during the scan committee, or if that goes out.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a couple more now. Staff, the first thing, if you see on the agenda, there is a vote. I think quite connected possibly to a public comment here regarding general fund Reinhardt's heart allocations. I will pass out the motion and comment that will be on the floor during the break. I'll pass out to council members and the public to give you a chance. And the second announcement for me, actually regarding Richard Sullivan, he did ask me to in some way tell his story, what's happened to him. You all know him, some of us for quite a while. So he is currently in care due to some of his health challenges. He's unfortunately had a very poor diagnosis. He is now paralyzed from the waist down. There's not particularly positive prognosis moving forward on that. Because he is dealing with this extreme health issue, he is planning on stepping back from his role as a council co-chair. He does want to stay on the council for now, at least to see if he's able to eventually come back to meeting, perhaps in a wheelchair, of course. That's why you see a vote on the agenda for the new council co-chair, who is a community member. And also to echo what Thomas said, he is definitely taking visitors. If you would like to visit him, he would more than welcome any visits. He's in very positive spirits, despite the extreme challenge he's facing now. and we'd love to see people. So if you'd like to visit them, let me know. Or Thomas know, we'll let you know where to go and we'll give you the contact information. Any questions about what you should be doing with that?
I just appreciate staff's connection and support. Multiple software stuff, I'll step in that way.
Yeah, I was just going to give a verbal one because I feel like I've been throwing tons of paper and stuff a little simple. So I just wanted to do a quick verbal recap of where we are. Some of it has already kind of surfaced. So in terms of funding, with Ryan White Part A and Ryan White Part B, the tagline is it will be flat funded. The feds introduced the change in formula. So it's where the person is currently living rather than when they're diagnosed. So we were facing about between a $500,000 to $600,000 cut every year cumulatively for 5 years. So that's been relieved by the state office of AIDS. They have something, they all get Part B, and a large part of that is their is ADAP, and there's rebate dollars that come in bulk purchasing and pharmacy. And so I think people have talked about the great work of community statewide advocates, some of them are here, so I want to add my thanks on to it. So the big piece that we still don't know about is the EHE funding. That is, and of course you guys know I'm talking about the care side, the prevention side, goes to the CDC, so a different process. And will they follow what they're doing for Ryan White Part A and Part B for the EHE funding? And don't have an answer yet. I've asked a few times over the past month, hopefully get one soon. But did elevate it to the state office names to ask if they do decide to follow the formula, we would likely get a cut, same revenue for Part A and Part B. If they would be able to absorb it, and they will take that under consideration. So hopefully this won't come to pass, but if it does, then hopefully we'll be back going by the app, by the Part B, we may not. So I'll stop there and before I move on to general fund. Nate, any questions on that? What's clear? Yes. Okay. So now we talk about general fund. So, and I think I'll be brief, but I'm happy if people want to hear more details. So, you know, this city has been hit usually hard by what's the implementation of OBO or HL1, which is the big changes that are happening to Medicaid. It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and then. Other things like the other kind of pillars of the economy also have, they've been doing okay, but it hasn't been able to overcome the increased cost of doing business as the adding on of services. So folks have kind of talked about what that's meant in terms of budgets. And it's not just BPA issues, there's directives across the board for kind of $800 million below where we need to be to stay flat funded. So I think there's 35 departments or something within the city and county, so everyone's taking a hit. In fact, the mayor has, you know, if rather than assign the results of Medicaid to change the Medicaid of HR1, just the EPH, it's been spread across all the departments. So there's been a set of targets that the mayor gives to each of the departments, and the departments parse it out to each of the divisions, and then the divisions parse it out to each of the sections. So HIV health services is a section. Our colleagues over in the prevention side are actually on the other side of the house. We're part of the health network. They are part of the population health division. So they're within the DPH, but all their cuts get parsed out in a different way. The same kind of thing. Like first it goes to the division, and then it goes to the section. So we get targets each year. We've had targets for the last couple of years. This year we had two. So someone was mentioning the $17 million cut. And on the care side, given what's happened in many other departments and sections, we were pretty fortunate. What we got cut was some of the training, which I showed you guys. Doesn't hold true on the prevention side. So they have to speak to that. So that was a $17 million cut. So then there was a second reduction that happened, which was $40 million. And that's for the same period starting July 1st, so just a few months. That has been divided in half. So the city has to, so the department has to find $20 million in savings, and that $20 million they pass these CEOs. So so that was what people are kind of raising here, because there's been discussions about this being shared. Again, each section is its target, the target they reported up. So the reason I'm sharing this now is really it's a question you guys will see later before you, which is, if there is a cut to HIV health services, and the truth, I don't know the answer to that. Each department has to put out some targets, and then you never know what happens. And there is a whole process that happens. It's a bunch of different lead levels, and you ultimately, the mayor makes a decision on it. It's not necessarily in the heads of the director, even DPH, or top, and they say yes, yes, no, or one more here, or this, or take this off the board. That's in the path to happen for HIV's care services. So that $20 million will go through a process that actually probably will hit public around April 5th. So the reason that you guys have a motion is the other side of the house, which we used to think of general fund as saved and stable and backfilling. So this is a brand new day for all of us, including us and HIV health services. But for the last 25 years, we've experienced reductions in Rhineland Part A. Part B from the state has kind of wobbled up and down, pretty much flat funded. So at this point, over half of the Rhineland Part A monies have been replaced or backed over general fund dollars. So how we when those cuts came, and we kind of have communicated over the past 25 years with the Planning Council, but we basically have said, where does it make sense to make the cuts? So rather than having people on two or three, sometimes even four different funding sources, we've once added open four different funding sources, because they all have different years, they all have different fiscal years. So we've just simplified it. So we really have tried to make it easier from a contract perspective. So the reason I share this with you, it doesn't mean that if something stayed on Part A or moved over to general fund, it's not a comment on the quality of the services, the essentialness of the services, the priority that you all allocated. It really was to simplify services. So that's how it's got to be. So now if we do take a general fund cut, how should it be absorbed? Should it be absorbed specifically by those that are now currently on general fund, or should it be spread across the board? So that Part A's would also be part of it, which would, if there's pluses and minuses to both, then I really think that's for you guys to decide. But wanted to make sure you guys are meaningfully involved. I also just kind of want to emphasize, this is proposed. There's, we modeled a $1 million thing. It could be $1 million, it could be $5, it could be $4 million. So we don't really, there's no special thing about, specifically about that number. But we wanted you guys to get a real sense of it, like, this significant cut. So I'll stop there. What was that? Well, the good news is already given the first half. No, I still have to be hearing about, can't even say the number of cuts that are potentially happening. It's not a happy. And the director of department health was having to fight other departments, which are saying, why are we absorbing the cuts for HR 1, and why aren't you just getting it? So, lest you all think it's a fight time agreement, high management. So, I'm going to stop there because that's not your fault. So.
No, not at all. I just want to also, so there's no questions, council, and I just want to make sure that I have an opportunity to ask any questions while the process. Any questions?
It's not down to the agenda, though.
It is.
Yeah,
as a point of order, I'm not sure why we're having this discussion right now.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Great. Anything? So I've got a couple different things, which is with regards to check updates. There's a lot of different activities happening within the branch. Only engaged with Vicente with regards to community engagement around current future family relief efforts. Hopefully, everybody here has had the opportunity to touch base and some of that process. If not, we have like what you intend how that has happened. Obviously, Jelly came here along that with us here. There have been a number of town halls and staff that we process. We actually had a also been a very then with regards to ETE and other efforts within the branch, there is we have our onboard set up event that we did last year, which was sorry, my voice is I've got allergies going on, my voice is starting to crack a little bit from that standpoint. So the onboard SF event that we did last year to help community-based organizations onboard new staff, just due to the fact that there's a lot of change that's happening within the system. And this is a one-day event for folks who are new to the field to get exposed to core responsibilities and efforts that are primary to the work that we do. So we're going to do that again in the fall. So we're looking at August 11th, potential date for that particular event. In the Latinos, it's happening as well in June, which is a speaking one-day event for supporting individuals who are Spanish speaking, ideally who are frontline staff who are in that kind of pressure point with regards to translation, understand both worlds and the particular stressors that happen for staff in the world. So the department can acknowledge that we want to support this third year for this particular event. Happening and today is all in Spanish. So it's been extremely successful and it's connecting quite desired for folks to come. And the other two components were just our capacity building efforts for our counselor trainings and getting people test very depth on testing technologies that are available to individuals that are providing work in the PH system and the HAP systems. So and then the state CBG, JP and I, they're looking at working to a Monterey spring of that CBG meeting in that particular area of the state, just it's a place that the CBG has not gone for to the fact that it's not a central location, it's a central location that we're in Monterey this year. Smaller. Any questions about any of that? Hopefully that would bottom up. Questions?
Yeah. So on March 10th, the House Appropriations Committee Subcommittee Labor HHS. Held its fiscal 2027 budget oversight hearing for National Institutes of Health programs on March 17th. Participate the subcommittee will accept programmatic requests for federal health programs through March 27th and held its fiscal year 2027 member date on March 5th. Member days are when members of Congress who are not on a specific committee are invited to testify regarding their legislative priorities, their constituent concerns, and funding requests. The Senate is going to hold their member day hearing on April 19th. The Senate remains deadlocked with the DHS negotiations that have held up the budget, the total budget negotiations. Those are still ongoing. And historically, the president's budget request to Congress, which is a non-binding proposal, lays out the administration's spending and policy priorities for the upcoming year, kicks off the appropriations process in early February, but the administration is not expected to issue their fiscal 2027 budget request until March 30th. Any questions?
Here. All right, Libra, you are up next.
Thank you all. My name is Leroy Blaya. I use he, him, and his pronouns. I'm the Part B HRSA State Administrator Representative, and I'm also the Ending the Epidemics Program Manager with the California Department of Public Health Office of AIDS, and I'm very pleased to be part of the council. Just a few updates. I wanted to give you the heads up that the state integrated plan, which is being refreshed and revised with new data and an updated list of priority populations that will include people living with HIV that are 50 years and older, will be ready for review in April. So we're going to be distributing that to all of our planning councils, commissions, and groups for review, and there'll be instructions on that review. And then sometime in April or in May, we'll have a concurrence vote about it. This is a parallel process to what's going on in San Francisco now with Vicente Consulting. This is the statewide plan that is submitted to HRSA and CDC, and it allows us to meet the requirement for a variety of planning documents that are required to be submitted by all jurisdictions that receive HIV prevention, care, and surveillance funding. We are doing two versions of this plan. One is a sanitized version that has language that meets the tests of executive orders. That is a bit of a longer plan. It has some different components to it, but our main concurrence document, as it was last time, is our short community-facing internal to California plan that has all of the all of the populations and data cited that allow us to describe the full syndemic of HIV, hepatitis C, and STIs within California and in San Francisco. So any questions, you can include those in the review documents that come along with those. Once again, this is not necessarily going to keep California from being targeted as a state that still centers people living with people that are transgender, gender nonconforming, undocumented populations, populations that are Black, African American, Latine. So all of these are still priority populations within our state, and we are not changing our websites internal to the state of California. So, but this removes the fight about the integrated plan up above the plan itself. And if they take issue with our plan in general and question it, then it will be a fight not at the level of the public health department, but at the level that's higher than public health department. So any questions, I'm happy to take them. I'm also going to be putting a information in the chat about a our annual Ending the Syndemic Symposium. I talked about this last time, so I'm not going to detail this, but we have a save the date website set up now. This is a way of looking backward and looking forward about how California is doing in addressing the syndemic of HIV, hepatitis C, and STIs through a social determinants of health lens. And of course, we have San Francisco and other jurisdictions that have sort of wrapped themselves around this concept of social determinants of health. We are making progress. There has been decreases among key populations in California of STIs, hepatitis C, and HIV infections, although some populations, including women, cisgender women, have seen increases each year since 2018 to 2023. So we're looking to have a more focused effort on those communities. Women of color in particular, and other populations that have not seen the same benefits in decreases in HIV, hepatitis C, and STIs as other populations. So that is in the chat. We are looking forward to having a really strong participation from San Francisco jurisdiction, as we always do, at the Ending the Syndemic Symposium. With that, you know, you're working really closely with Vicente Consulting. They're amazing. You're doing some community engagement in the San Francisco local health jurisdiction and EMA that really is model for the entire state. But there is a workshop series that we provide free of charge through Vicente Consulting that helps providers and other partners, syndemic partners, understand a little bit about what we mean when we talk about the social determinants of health, of racial equity, economic justice, health access for all, mental health and substance use, nothing without us, nothing about us without us, all these things that we do in providing stigma-free services. So helping us to understand that more in dialogue, Fazendi Consulting is presenting a workshop series. I'll put the save the dates in the chat and they'll be distributed with the minutes, but we're going to be distributing registration links sooner to the dates of those workshops. So I'm happy to take any questions. Oh, really briefly also, there is going to be that free PrEP navigation certification training that's happening April 23rd and April 21st. It is a way to get some CEU credits and get like a certificate, a national certificate, nationally recognized certificate for prep navigation. This is free of charge, and it's going to be held in partnership with Health HIV, and it's online, it's virtual, so it's a way to actually get staff trained and staff to have an additional certification. Last time, switching to another topic, we had a guest that was our a representative from DHCS, Medi-Cal Eligibility, the supervisor of the person that's going to be permanently assigned to each one of the planning councils, commissions, a group across California. So he introduced himself, Michael Freeman, at the last meeting. The person that's going to be taking that assignment, his direct report, I think, is going to be returning from leave in April. And so that person will submit their name for regular application to each planning council, commission, and group, and they'll go through the normal process that the HIV San Francisco HIV Planning Council has set up for applications, and you'll get a chance to meet that person. And that person will be in coordination with me and showing up to each of the meetings to provide information about DHCS and Medi-Cal program eligibility in particular. I'm happy to take any questions.
I'm not seeing any questions in the room, Jordan. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Don't have any slides. Can folks hear me from here? Okay. But there are a couple of handouts. One says, End the Epidemics Coalition 2026-27 budget request, and then two real fact sheets that look like this. And I will be referencing them. I just got back from vacation, or else I might have, if I'd been in the office last week, I would have put together some slides for you and made this look pretty. But this is what you're getting instead. I'm Laura Chemis. I am a council member, and I am the senior director of HIV and harm reduction policy at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. And I have been asked the last few years, at least, to give updates on where things are at the state level around budgets and legislation of relevance and interest to this planning council and what this council works on, so primarily HIV. And so one of the things, and Bill referenced this a little bit earlier, at the state level, so you know where we stand with this federal administration around HIV, and they are actively doing what they can to undermine, eliminate, just those public health broadly and HIV specifically. At the local level, you also heard Bill talk about the budget challenges that the city and the health department are facing. But one of the things that, for a number of different reasons, is happening at the state level that's a little different is the state actually has a substantial amount of money set aside for HIV services right now. And so the state, so I think everyone here is familiar with the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, pays for medication for people living with HIV. It also covers, at this point, we have essentially a similar program that covers PrEP medication, but that is a federal program in California. Early on, in conjunction with some of the other larger states, realized that California, New York, other states were some of the largest purchasers of HIV medications from pharmaceutical companies, and decided to start using that purchasing power to get rebates on the medications from the pharmaceutical companies. And at this point, all of the state ADAP programs participate in this rebate program. And it generates, California continues to be one of the largest purchasers of HIV medication, unsurprisingly. And so has generated hundreds of millions of dollars in rebate funds. And so we all became aware that the state was sitting on a substantial amount of rebate dollars when the governor's Department of Finance realized that there was money sitting there and borrowed it to help build the state's deficit. So there is, as of right now, $900 million in ADAP rebate dollars that have been borrowed by the Department of Finance to help build the state budget deficit. We have been working as advocates for the last few years to, and when they borrowed it, they, you know, wrote into the budget, like this money, when it would be repaid, and they've got a repayment plan for it. But then they kept borrowing more money. So it's kind of kept going. As advocates, our firm belief is that that money belongs providing services for people with HIV and people at risk of HIV and should not be sitting in the, you know, governor's budget numbers making up this shortfall. So we've been working for several years on that. And so a lot of what we are proposing at the state level this year is the beginning of that process of getting that money reinvested in the community, redirected the services for people with HIV and HIV prevention services. And we also see this as this should be spent in a broader sort of systemic approach, addressing, in addition to HIV, viral hepatitis, STIs, and overdose. So that's what this proposal is for this year. And one of the things that I want to credit my colleague and coworker, Jonathan Croxway, for this approach, look at all of the programs that the state is currently funding, the different initiatives that we have, many of which, you know, like the PrEP one, I mean, over 50 organizations, when the state says we've got money for PrEP navigation, over 50 organizations across the state applied for it and said we want to provide this. But because of the small amount of money the state put into that particular program, they only funded six programs out of it. So Jonathan reasonably enough said, well, how much money would it cost to fund all 53 of them? And then that's what we're asking for that program this year. So everything that I'm going to go over in terms of this is something that is currently working. It's effective. We know how to do it. It would just be expanding it so that everyone across the state would be able to access these services instead of just a handful of them. The other thing that we have been asking for this money to be used for, that money set aside last year, and you also heard Bill reference this, is using this money at the state level to backfill any federal cuts. And so we've been having a lot of problems with this federal administration. From the point of HIV, we've been having two main problems with them. One is programs that they've just been cutting, particularly on the research, and that's where California has felt most of the cuts in terms of HIV is research. But we've also, you know, had multiple attempts at cutting. So the CDC HIV prevention money that they want to cut, California, Colorado, Illinois, and Minnesota. You figure out what the connection is between those four states. And there have been lawsuits, so those are being held off for now. But we know that they want to cut those. The other thing that that's been happening with this administration, and whether this is malice or incompetence, I leave that to everyone to make your own call on this, is just that they've been letting us know very, very late in the cycle when the money would be coming, so that we're waiting until after the contract cycle is supposed to begin to know whether we're getting the money, we're getting the same amount of money, or if they're cutting it. And that makes it, you know, impossible to plan services. It puts health departments in a tough situation. LA County was in this situation last year, and they ended up having to cut all of their contracts with community-based organizations because they didn't know if the money was coming or not. And their, you know, financial policies were such that if you don't know if it's coming, you have to assume it's not. And so the money did come through, but it came through late. And so part of what we've been doing is trying to give the state office of aid specifically, the authority to say, okay, we are, you know, we've got this pot of money here. If this, if it looks like the feds aren't coming through, if the feds are actually cutting something, we can use this money. Or even if we don't know yet if it's coming through or not, but maybe we can front this money to the county so that they can keep services going until we know whether the feds are coming in with the money or not. So that's, that is another thing that we've been trying to do over the last couple of years. And we are fortunate to have excellent leadership at the State Office of AIDS, who's been very, very on top of this, trying very hard to be as flexible as they can be within the constraints that they have to try to make sure that the community level services are continuing and that nobody is being dropped out of care. So that said, I'm going to go through. Do people have any questions about that? All right. So we have many things that are labeled end the epidemics or ending the epidemics or ending the HIV epidemic. Everybody collectively seems to have decided to use that, but there are different ones. So when Leroy was talking about the ETE strategy at the state level, that is different, and that is different from like Thomas's updates on what ETE is doing here or EAT funding. The End the Epidemics Coalition is a statewide group of HIV advocates and service providers and people living with HIV across the state. So we all have the same things, but we're unrelated. I know that's not helpful, but so the statewide ETE coalition is coalition of advocates and organizations around the state. We have a lot of Zoom calls, and we do an annual day of action in Sacramento. And part of what we do is develop our budget proposal every year to say what we think the priorities are, how the state should be spending HIV funding, worked with the legislature to try to get that in the budget, also to fend off any potential cuts to HIV services in the budget. And so what's in this document that you have is our proposal for this year, and it is very focused on trying to spend down some of this DDAP rebate dollars and expand existing programs, as I just said. So I will go through them, and if folks have questions about any of them, let me know. So the first one is money to expand, called the PrEP and PEP Initiation and Retention Initiative. And this is essentially PrEP navigation. So there's a separate program that helps pay for PrEP medication or PrEP app program. This is separate from that. This is about PrEP navigator. So if you walk into a clinic and you think you want to start PrEP, this is somebody who can help you walk through the, does your insurance cover it? Do you need to get it free from the state or through Gilead? And are there any challenges? And where are you going to go to get your regular testing? And just help people walk through what can be a sort of complicated process. Sometimes it's a complicated emotional process, and then it's a complicated insurance process, but somebody who's there to help walk you through all of that. In particular, we've learned that at the state level, PrEP continues to be really underutilized, particularly among Latino and Black African American communities. And so this money has been trying to particularly target those communities to ensure that people have access to PrEP if they want to be on PrEP. And so the ask is for $33.8 million to be spent over 4 years. And again, that's the one where they got 53 applications. They only funded 6. They're like, okay, let's fund all of them. And then the next one is for rapid ART. And this is for early initiation of antiretroviral treatment for people who are newly diagnosed with HIV. We know now that the earlier folks get started on antiretrovirals as soon after diagnosis as possible, the better their health outcomes will be. And so this is a similar program for people who are newly tested positive to help provide that sort of navigation and support to help people stay on, get on and stay on antiretroviral treatment. It's an ask for $14.5 million, again, over 4 years. Again, they got 33 applications, but they only were only needed 104. Yes, Sarah.
It's really fast. It's an old concern that I haven't heard about RESPA at all for the last decade or so. And that is, with that rapid part, is part of that programming, or do you understand if there's any programming still around PEP?
PEP? Yes. So PEP is, so PEP and PrEP are slightly different, even though they use the same medications, but PrEP is pre-exposure prophylaxis, so that's medication you take before you're potentially exposed to HIV, and PEP is post-exposure prophylaxis, so that's what you would take after you think you've been exposed, whether that's, you know,
within 72 hours.
Yeah, so whether that's sexual activity, sharing injection equipment, occupational exposure, yes, so PEP. Fewer people need PEP than PrEP, fortunately. But yes, the PEP is covered under the first one. The name is actually the PrEP and PEP Initiation and Retention Initiative, and it's included in that. Yes, thanks for asking the question. And then $14.1 million is what we're asking for Project Cornerstone. This is a program that is targeting people living with HIV who are over 50 and long-term survivors with a particular focus on communities of color. I know you all are well aware here because we often talk about it for good reason. The extent to which we have a population who is fortunately aging with HIV and the challenges thereof. When the state put out the last RFA for this, they got 14 applications, but they were only able to fund four. And so this would enable more counties in the state to be able to particularly target the population of folks aging with HIV. $30 million to expand routine opt-out testing in emergency departments. We know that routine opt-out, meaning the standard of care if you show up in an emergency department, is that they give you they test you unless you say you don't want to. And what we know is that often if you ask people, do you want to get this test? People will often say no. But if you say, we're going to give you this test unless you say you don't want it, it's still consent, but it just somehow psychologically makes it easier for people to say yes, like let's do this testing. And what we know is that emergency departments, people are continuing to show up in emergency departments, not recognizing that they may be at risk for HIV, or STIs or viral hepatitis. And so it's a very effective way to reach folks who may not be reached by our other HIV testing initiatives and outreach programs and things like that. California, through the Bridge Project, started helping emergency departments. The other thing, emergency departments are often very overworked, very understaffed, very under-resourced. And so the state started giving grants to emergency departments to help them to develop the infrastructure that they needed to do more of this routine opt-out testing for STIs, for hepatitis, as well as HIV. Similarly, they got applications from 73 emergency departments, but only able to fund 28 of the money they have. So this would expand that further across the state. This fifth one is around housing. And again, I do not need to tell this particular planning council the necessity, the urgency, and the expense of providing housing for people living with HIV. The idea here is to invest another $50 million in housing, and then that money would essentially go be sort of added to the CAQA money that counties are already getting to be able to provide additional housing for people living with HIV. This one's a little bit complicated on our end because it would go, housing funding goes through a different mechanism at the state level than HIV funding does, and counties often manage housing money differently than they manage healthcare money, public health money. So it's gonna be a little bit complicated to get it out the door, but we also understand the role in housing funds. Again, I don't need to tell you all. One, we've got another one time. Last year, we got some additional money in the budget to purchase these new hepatitis C point of care tests that provide really fast turnaround and information for people to know whether they have hep C or not, which enables people to get on treatment faster, which enables us to cure their hep C faster. So like that, and it's been however many years since we got a cure for hep C, and I'm still just so happy that we can cure hep C now. But that's just a one-time thing to provide training on how to use the new testing machines. And then one of the other things that we're trying to do is pull down money. The state of California, City of County, San Francisco, and every other governmental entity sued. We've got these opioid settlement funds that are suing Purdue Pharmaceuticals and others around their role in increasing vulnerability to opioid use disorder and overdose death. And so the state of California has a large pot of money in their opioid settlement funds. We currently are using money there to fund the California Overdose Prevention and Harm Reduction Initiative. We're asking for that money to be continued. And we are also asking for money out of that to CM drug checking services in California. Drug checking is using FTIR technology to help people who use drugs understand what is in their substances, so they can make better decisions about when and how to use it, if they want to use it, as well as just giving people a fair amount of sort of autonomy and control and information. It also gives us at the community level sort of early warning around what might be present in the illicit drug supply, which can be really useful. San Francisco AIDS Foundation has a drug checking program here in San Francisco. And I'm very happy to talk more about that, but we're trying to get some state funding for state funding for now. So those are the budget requests from each. Do people have any questions about those? Yes, let's
A couple of questions. So when we talk about overdose, we're talking about only overdose from opioids, not overdose with things like methanol or drugs and everything. And second question, and you can put that together. I'm very, very concerned because, of course, in the news just came out that they're going to put the ICE people working at the airport. We already have underuse of PrEP, of prevention and other things in the people with vulnerable community. How is this bubble fear in, especially in my Latino people and other people, is gonna be affecting all this system? And what are we doing already, if anything, to help? Because then the people, they're not coming out from their home. I have talked to some people on the mission, and even to work, they're working less. So I just the question, your insight.
Yes, thank you. Those are good questions. So in terms of overdose, fentanyl is an opioid, so a fentanyl overdose is an opioid overdose. In terms of the California Overdose Prevention and Harm Reduction Initiative, that's overdose for any substances, for anything. They provide, you know, naloxone, which works on opioid overdoses, including fentanyl overdoses, but doesn't work on a stimulant overdose, for example, or something else. But part of what the co-free funded programs do is provide people with information around a variety of different substances, whether it's, you know, alcohol or stimulants, especially methamphetamine, and sort of the ways that that can cause harm, and giving people the tools to take care of themselves. So it's a really co-free funded programs do a really great job of identifying, you know, helping folks identify what their vulnerability might be, how to access the tools or information that they need in order to address that. And in fact, what we know from surveys of co-free funded programs is that the substance that's being used most frequently across California is stimulants. It's not opioids, particularly methamphetamine is the most commonly used substance based on their surveys of their participants. Which is why we need to, you know, not get so focused on opioids that we miss the larger things that may be making, maybe affecting people's health and their health outcomes and well-being. And that didn't even include alcohol, which I have a feeling you asked, actually the really most frequently used and often most dangerous substance for folks. In terms of the other question around how do we ensure access to services for folks who may be justifiably afraid, right? And I think, you know, in some ways that's a question for, like, for the Department of Public Health, for our larger health systems. That's not just an HIV question, that's a larger health systems question. And that's where it is so important for places like San Francisco to really uphold our sanctuary laws. If, you know, like, you may have seen footage from SFO that showed San Francisco Police Department, you know, uniformed employees standing around apparently protecting ICE, right, while they were engaged in their work, which is a violation of San Francisco's sanctuary ordinance. So I am hopeful that people will put pressure on the police department and on our local government to make sure that those sorts of things don't happen, because I look at that and it looks a lot like that's, you know, city employees aiding and abetting ICE in their lately illegal activities. That's my personal opinion. I obviously don't speak for the city in any way whatsoever on this or anything else, but it is concerning to me. And I think the more that, you know, certainly that people see things like that, the harder it's going to be to get people into services. So I also think, you know, this city, we did a lot of very creative work during COVID of taking services to people when they couldn't come to services. And I think we need to continue to be thinking about how we do that. Yeah.
So given that this money isn't coming from feds, it is within our state and controlled from within our state. And these are sort of very big numbers, but they're like very generalized categories. And I'm certain that there are projects in each of these areas that will address this, but I need to hear it plainly. We're just talking at one of the presentations we heard, you were talking about health disparities and social determinants of health. I need to confirm that there's going to be a purposeful effort that in each of these categories that Latin Brown
particularly populations
will be addressed, and it will be a particular focus in some way.
And to some extent, that is a question that, you know, so you heard from Leroy and obviously from Shelley and Vicente about the
plan and the strategy, and you heard from the state how much addressing racial disparities is a core part of their strategy. It's one of the pillars of the state strategy. And so this money is going to go to the State Office of AIDS to then send it out in a part B process or send it out to the different counties. And so we are, in many ways, we're counting on the State Office of AIDS to make sure that that money is distributed in ways that address racial disparities. It's also something that we as advocates are writing in to the request for money and the ways that we describe it. So like the PrEP and PEP initiative, we are basing some of our arguments for that on the fact that PrEP is continuing to be so underutilized, particularly among Latino communities, for example, which then also gets to some of these issues, right? And so, as advocates, we are saying from the beginning, this needs to be, these funds need to be used to prioritize communities of color. And then we're also going to need to hold the State Office of AIDS accountable to their own priorities around making sure that the money gets used in ways that a lot of the money is getting to the communities that are most in need. And then we are also going to have to work to hold our local health department, that money is coming to the local health department, to say, if you're getting this money from the state, where and how are you using it? And does it track what we know about where the other money is going? So that's a roundabout answer to your question. So we're trying to write it in everywhere we can, and we're going to have to continue to hold folks like Leroy and his colleagues accountable for living up to their priorities.
It'd be really great if we can create a strategy and how we can hold accountable for exactly those things before it goes out and become, this is what we have right now. Maybe better luck next year or something.
So we have a couple more minutes.
Thank you, Thomas.
Yes. So two hands, no good. So, yeah.
Okay, so thank you. This is comprehensive and quite fleshed out. Two quick questions. I see a lot of sort of like looking back at RFPs that have been submitted openly, so you could speak to that, but that's a completely like a new RFP process for these categories. And then the second question that I had been kind of addressed here with the response to the so.
Yeah, we are mostly using the RFPs as sort of a measure for how much need there is out there. So, you know, once this money gets to the State Office of AIDS, they will undoubtedly need to issue a new RFP, RFA for the money. They won't, I mean, the language may look, they may be able to recycle part of it, but they'll have to do a new process to get that money out. We're mostly using that to say, look, here's how much. You know, here's one measure of the unmet need for this, that there were 53 organizations in the state that really wanted to do this and wanted to do this enough to put together a proposal. And then you only had enough money to fund six of them. Like, there's at least, 50 organizations that want to do this. Let's just, that it was sort of a shorthand for here's what the need is. If they put it out again, it may be the 100 organizations say we want to provide these services, in which case we'll go back and say, hey, look, let's spend more of this money. You know, ultimately, we want every organization that wants to be providing prep navigation and has a community in need to be able to do that research.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Help us understand how these programs are being funded by the ADAP program. When the cuts to programs that Bill talked about are going to be cut, and how those dollars cannot be used for local programs?
Not the way it's currently set up. I'm not averse to trying to figure that out, but as it's sort of conceptualized now, we've been thinking of the federal government as the primary entity that was cutting HIV services because they've been so blatantly hostile right, from the beginning, and because those are large contracts often, large grants that help fund state programs and so on. So we've been very focused on, you know, backfilling federal cuts. We've not talked to the State Office of AIDS, and we've not really thought about backfilling local cuts. One of the things that I as an advocate, it's like that I would hear in that is that that would give the mayor here the sort of excuse to cut more HIV funding. And then if we didn't, weren't able to continue to get it at the state level, we'd be stuck with cuts here. So, yeah, it's a good question.
It's definitely great. Maybe Mark,
So I want to ask my colleague Andy before he leaves to give a short comment about how people can get involved in this process.
So hey all, thanks Laura. So you all heard what it is that we're advocating for, what the agenda is, what the final word to see about it. I want to plug two quick things. So if you want to get involved, if you want to share with your community. The first thing that's coming up is what we'll already mentioned is May 6th. We're having in the Epidemic State of Action. This is the coalition that's helping bring forward these asks at the state level. There will be hundreds of advocates from all across the state coming up to advocate for these budget proposals. We'll be speaking with legislators in the state capitol and representatives in the governor's office to kind of really lift this up and share, you know, personal stories about what the real impact of these funding allocations are to our communities. The second thing is if you're interested in diving in a little bit more and going a little bit deeper, we are going to have our HIV Advocacy Network meeting in April, which will be April the 6th. It's a Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. at Strike and Castro. We're going to do a deep dive on all the budget items, budget proposals, and we'll also talk about the sign up sheet for folks who want to plug in and sign up to join the Day of Action. So that's another great point for folks to come join, learn a little bit more, and decide if they want to join our contingent up to Sacramento from San Francisco and get involved and find out what we've got.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. And I handed out fact sheets for two bills that the San Francisco AIDS Foundation is co-sponsoring this year. One is around Hep C and private insurance coverage for Hep C treatment. The other one is around PrEP and insurance coverage for PrEP. As you all know, insurance is often the biggest barrier to people getting access to these both vaccine treatment and to PrEP. And so we're trying to slice away one barrier at a time in our ongoing attempt to make it easier to hear. But if you have questions about the bills, feel free to ask me after this.
Before you exit, I just want to thank you for your efforts and being on the CPG state. It's really nice to have such a healthy relationship with San Francisco and the state. And I really can't go through those meetings that you thought highly about the efforts that are happening. So just to see the programming happen as a result of all that, actually inspiring. So thank you.
Yes.
Can we take a break?
Yeah.
I thought it was the HML. Yeah.
Yes, you mean
it's not
Yeah. Yeah,
All right, let's go ahead and back over back. So Mark is gonna take the next two agenda items.
All right, hi everyone. Welcome back to the meeting. As I mentioned during staff update, we do have our consumer services chair stepping back, which means that we now have an open community chair. Just as a reminder, Richard Sullivan filled the community chair designated for consumer of services. This position does not need to be affiliated or unaffiliated. The attribute is consumer of services, which means HIV positive and must be willing to publicly disclose their sero status. So the nominations are now open for our community chair with this particular designation. Floor remains open. I know that Ron is going to nominate someone. Ron is conveniently not here right now.
Send it about.
I don't know if it's or not. You'll patiently await. So, just as a reminder, you are able to nominate yourself if you're so bold. Still no one taking the space. Well, we'll just simply sit here and stare at each other. Can we find a community co-chair to fill this spot? Yes, Derek, excellent. Who do you nominate?
Himself.
All right.
I'll second it. Okay. Lee Drew was seconding that motion. Therefore, I don't need to ask you if you accept this nomination. Very well. Are there any other nominations? Besides Derek Mann or community co-chair. Yes, Ron.
I'd like to nominate Jesus Ian.
Jesus Ian, do you accept this nomination?
Yes.
Is there a second to this nomination?
Okay.
There's a second from Elaine. All right, we have a competition. Are there any other nominations? The floor is still open. So we do not vote on this. Unfortunately, I did word the agenda incorrectly. This is simply collect names. At the next meeting, anyone else may continue to nominate folks, but we now have two potential chairs. All right, so before we close this, any last nominations besides Casey Squeehan and Derek Mack? All right, we'll bring those forward next month.
Sorry. No, say the nomination. Can you come in?
Yes, I can.
And how would that happen? Email?
You can email me and I will bring it up, but it's probably best to do it here in person because I'll nominate you in the entire. But you can certainly email me. That's happened in the past. Someone has been shy and emailed their person or themselves to me, and I just brought it up and asked for a second to them. So that's fine too.
Okay. I didn't know that was a problem. Thank you.
Any other questions on this agenda item? Again, apologies for phrasing this incorrectly. It does need to be noted 30 days in advance, people. All right, moving on to the next item. I passed out the motion that is coming from the steering committee. It's a pretty short motion. You all have it. I also passed it out to the public. So I will do my best to explain it, and then I will invite there's any question, Bill, to actually answer any questions. But I'll explain it, and then I'll actually, we'll put up an example of what that could look like, but not quite yet. Let's first look at this motion. I'll read it out loud. Councilmember Jewell moves to respond to potential general fund reduction by proportionally reducing both general fund and Ryan White's Part A service category. So this motion on the floor is asking the council to consider if there is a cut to basically share the pain across general fund and Ryan White Part A proportionately per the model that the council has approved during last year's summit. I use an example that seemed to people seem to understand during the steering committee, and I will do it again. So let's say there are a total of three service categories, three service providers within the service category X that are paid for on by general funds. And there are three that are paid for under Ryan White Part A. Let's say the cut is $300,000 to that service category. That means that each of those three general fund funded service agencies will each take a 100K cut. They're all having the same amount on their contract, fortunately. That makes sense, right? Now, if this motion passes, then the cut is actually spread across all six, the three in Ryan White Part A, the three in general fund, which would, of course, be a 50K cut. So that's basically what this cut, scenario would look like. But we have modeled it as well for an up to $1 million contribution. So again, as Bill underlined during his piece in HHS update, we have not received specifically an amount. This is for your
expanded, please.
I think we will go to, yeah, there we go. All right, so here's an example. So that is a motion on the floor. It has been moved by steering and seconded, so there's no need to move further, but the floor is now open for questions. Ron, and then
I just learned a while ago that instead of general funds would be the state that would be covering the backfills. Does that change the motion?
No. So the state backfill is specifically the Ryan White reduction, either local general fund reduction. And then we asked the question, could they? And then Laura answered, we haven't gone there yet. Maybe not. So at this point, it would be fine.
So I need a clarification because I brought this up in steering, but I still don't understand. So if the Ryan White funds are paid by the resort, we have Medicare that will cover. If that doesn't happen, it goes down to Medi-Cal.
And from there, the general fund is going to take I don't understand what we get into it.
I think I've understood your question, but I haven't. Okay. So Ryan White is continued to consider treatment of last resort. So what it means is other federal or private insurance. So the qualifier for Ryan White, you have to not have Medi-Cal or Medicare. Also for our general fund programs, we have the same criteria. So those programs are funded through general fund. It's treatment of last resort. And so actually local general fund is considered kind of inferior in terms of the hierarchy of building down. So theoretically, if you run a general fund program and run another program and it's funded by Ryan White, you could go there. But we hold it the same. So if you had Medi-Cal and Medicare, you wouldn't be able to enroll in the Ryan White Part A unless it was service not covered by that. Or for general fund, so it's the same. Did I answer the question?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Laura.
So, first of all, I want to say I support this motion. I think it is the most equitable way to approach this. I would like to propose an amendment that we add another sentence at the beginning of this motion that the HIV Community Planning Council asks SF Department of Public Health to not cut HIV services towards our goal of getting to zero in San Francisco and in line with San Francisco's historical commitment to services for people living with HIV.
Please repeat that.
Never good, yeah. The HIV Community Planning Council asks San Francisco Department of Public Health to not cut HIV services towards our goal of getting to zero in San Francisco, in line with San Francisco's the services for people living with HIV. And so my intent in this is that first and foremost, we're asking the department not to cut services for people living with HIV, and then leave the motion as it is. If they do cut it, we ask that they be cut this way.
I'll second that.
All right, the discussion now is about this amendment. It is not about the motion, it is about the amendment that has been proposed.
Any discussion?
This is a policy decision. I think you could actually have a lot of
favor. Oh, we can do.
Yeah.
Let me get a couple of comments. So, public comment.
I'm new to this, or sort of new to this, please forgive me. If you cut programs like evenly across the board, is it figured like a disparate impact? For the people, say if you did a program for housing and you did PrEP or something like that, say you did across, the person for housing would probably be disproportionately impacted. Is that figured in when you make those cuts? A disparate impact on the people receiving those services.
Bill, do you want to answer that? Or
I can. I think someone from the group has to ask it.
Sorry. So from a procedural standpoint, we can't dialogue with the public with regards to the question. So we can hear you speak, but we can't go back and forth. Sorry. I'm happy to speak to you.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not that question. Yes. So, you know,
PJ, first, and I'll go back. Not responding to that, there's something similar that I had an initial question about. I was wondering if the group actually had a conversation around the way that we've done our initial planning. We've often held certain categories here. From the first percentage of the cuts out.
Yeah, and absolutely. There was no discussion it was understood. As they're using the model that we approved last summit, that actually is the model that you see actually on the screen. That's why you're not seeing all the service categories, because of our own model that was approved last year.
I just want to raise again that the state is contributing more than $600,000 to the federal government, and we ought to get some credit for that. And I'm not sure who to hold the fire talking about that, but that is $600,000 that should be applied towards us, as opposed to them being able to just take it for granted.
Any other discussion?
All right, if there's no more public comment or discussion, all those in favor of the amendment, not only the motion, the amendment to the motion, please raise your hand. Any opposed? Any abstentions?
Point of order, I actually don't think that I'm able to vote on general fund distribution cuts at the local level, and that's just so I'm going to abstain at this time, but I'll leave it there. I'll check on if I'm able to vote on local general fund cuts, but at this point I'm going to abstain, so thanks.
Thank you, Leroy. That actually makes sense if you would not, for sure. I'll ask Irma as well. Sorry, there's a
sure. Thank you.
Irma, did you hear that?
Yes, I did, and yes, I support that.
Marco is unable to vote. Yeah, Marco is the Irma has special dispensation to join the remotely. All of the council members who join us, they have that special dispensation actually at function as members of the public.
Yeah.
All right. So now we are back to the original motion that is now amended with Laura's language preceding the motion itself. Again, the motion as amended. The HCPC and SFPPH asked to not cut HIV services towards our goal of getting to zero in San Francisco, and in line with San Francisco's historical commitment to services for people living with HIV. CM Jewell removes the responsive potential general fund reduction by proportionately reducing both general fund and Ryan White Party service. Yeah, I think it's been missing a bridge sentence, right? So maybe if cuts do occur. Yeah. All right, discussion is now open on the amended motion. Yeah.
So the intent of this, if I understand it correctly, is that the should there be general fund reductions, then so could you walk us through just
Sorry, you were asking about the logic.
So what this does is mirrors the same process as you guys did for prioritization and allocation for the last 15 years. You said if there's a cut, let's do it proportionally. And then you also further said if the cut is below a certain amount, let's focus on the essential, the same services that you find the essential benefits package or the core services. So when you see all of those up there, those are $1 million cuts. So it keeps with that model. So all those green ones are the core services. And then you see option on the left-hand side, if you just do, my vision's not making it, but if I'm remembering correctly, that's the general fund only. So that's the dollar amount. And then that second column there tells you the number of programs are impacted. So if you do both general fund and Ryan White Part A, so that third column tells you the amount of money for that service category. And it tells you the number of programs impacted. So that's worth that cut. So if you include Ryan White Part A, more programs are cut, less overall. There's an exception to that overall. So you're spending the pain over more than you're using it's less.
Any better discussion from council members before we go to public? Seeing none, public comment. All right. Seeing none, votes.
So we will do a roll call vote. It's definitely involved funding. Do I need to read the motion on the floor?
No.
Okay, Evans.
Yes.
Robert Arnold? Hey, let's keep in mind, you counted the minimum votes that are out of the decision.
Because of the service count,
I should give a reminder about conflict of interest. Thank you.
He's like waving that around.
Yeah, absolutely. So this involves multiple service categories. You have a conflict of interest in any of those service categories, your recusal for conflict of interest is understood for that service category. So say if you vote yes or no, you're voting yes or no on all of the other service categories and recusing on the specific service category where you have a conflict of interest.
So you can vote.
Yes. I'm not trying to sway your vote toward that.
Hey, make it for the clarification.
Yeah. Leroy, play.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Abstain, yes.
Anna Brazuela.
Yes.
And Chitty.
Yes.
Elaine Flores.
Yes.
Jesus Queen.
Yes.
Ron Hernandez.
Yes.
Lee Jewel.
Yes.
Thomas Noble.
Stay.
Nali.
Yes.
Derek Matt.
Good.
Yana Oscar.
Yes.
Irma Ferrado.
Yes.
JP Soto.
Yes.
Laura Thomas.
Yes.
Manuel Vasquez.
Yes.
All right, motion carries.
So acknowledge our ability to do a very complex process. We're going to do that. All right, that being said, we're on your ready to go. All right. Well, thank you so much for having me again. It's lovely to be back here. I think this is the sixth of these suckers that I've done, which is wow. I want to thank my boss, Matt. I also want to quickly lift up Jordan, who's a volunteer who has supported me through this process this year at a very needed time. So thank you all. And council staff for everything that you've done to support. I'm looking to first increase everybody's knowledge of AGCAP or refresh everybody's knowledge of what the program does and my methodology. I will provide a summary of the data from last year, from the 2024 to 2025-26 contract year, and then I will discuss some challenges, some successes that we had in the program, and also make myself available for any questions that folks have. So what is it? HCAP stands for the HIV Consumer Advocacy Project. It exists to support consumers of Ryan White Care programs or HHS-funded programs
as well as service providers who receive funding that I know of. It is a unique program. I was actually supported by DPH recently to submit an abstract for the National Rhineland Care Conference. I found out today that that did not happen, but I did want to acknowledge, you know, the support that I had from everybody that gave me feedback on that. So we'll try again next year. So some terminology quickly. Consumer is a person who is accessing services, living with HIV in the San Francisco DMA, which is actually a smaller service area than what AORP in general provides. It's only Marin, San Francisco, and San Mateo counties. They either have to be accessing the Ryan White Care Program or programs funded by HHS. A service provider means anybody who receives that funding. And that is most of our sister agencies and partners. One of the things about being an attorney is it does like serve an adversarial system. I sit outside of that as far as my methodology, and I focus on area of law called alternative dispute resolution. And what I find for our most vulnerable members, who are not necessarily served by the legal system in the best way, is that a less adversarial method not only serves their interests better, but it also serves their overall health outcome better. Just to kind of talk a little bit about this process, I'll share, you know, on the far left-hand side of this, we're talking about the unassisted negotiation. That's the point of contract. You don't have a lawyer representing, you don't have any support. You sign the lease and you move in, or you don't sign the lease and then you move out, but you move somewhere else, okay? I'd like to acknowledge up front that assumes there's equal bargaining power, but for our folks, there really never is that, right? You have folks who are, one, are connected to the system of care here. They can't just move somewhere else, right? They might have to change their positions, their entire care team. They may be subject to a subsidy, and it has to, that is required, or a voucher that's required to be used within San Francisco, like a, you know, particular hop-up one. So the equal bargaining power there, the choice that many people do have to move elsewhere, is not there. And that only amplifies as we get further along in this very, you know, in this process of dispute resolution. And on the far right hand side, that's kind of when you're talking about the second litigation is based on, you know, what you think of as a trial with a jury or judge, and you know, that is a very, very small percentage of litigation. Very few cases actually make it to that point. But litigation really is any communication to a court, or you know, even pre-litigation can be a really stressful time. That's the time when somebody gets a notice on their door. And oftentimes that's when we're running into, you know, our clients on some very difficult days because you're being forced into having to do something that you wouldn't have otherwise done, whether it's, you know, change your behavior or you know, pay rent that you know, with money you don't have, right? It can be an incredibly stressful time. So what I try to do is I try to keep breakfast in this middle ground to keep things before they get to that incredibly challenging part. And there's a lot of different methods to that. Mediation has a lot of, it goes by many, many names. You know, arbitration is kind of like litigation. It's some more relaxed rules of evidence, and it's a little bit less formal, but typically it still is one person making a determination that you will then have to abide. So it's still a very stressful experience. Mediation can be facilitative, which, you know, would be what I try to do, which is meet with folks to try and come to some understanding what is the underlying root need that people are missing, you know, to get over the conflict. Caucusing is a little different, where the judge puts one person in one room, the defendant in another, and runs back and forth and kind of comes to somewhere in the middle where nobody is really very happy with the decision. Sometimes I have to do a combination of these things. It's very rare that I get 3 hours to sit down with a service provider and a consumer to kind of understand where everybody's emotions are. Most consumers don't have the bandwidth for that. Many service providers simply don't have the time. So a lot of that kind of communication happens on both ends.
to help people communicate what they do. And I have various methods that I use, which we'll talk about, you know, the grievance process, et cetera. But I like to, you know, this is, again, I'm not a healthcare provider, but I can share just from my own lived experience how stressful it is and the effect that it has, the deleterious effect that it has on our health. When I'm in the middle of litigation, when you're dealing with an opposing counsel who's very difficult to manage, or a timeline that's very stressful that is, you know, perhaps unmeetable. So overall, I think that our clients are served more better by working through a conflict in a non-adversarial supported way. Obviously, you guys are very familiar with the types of services that we're talking about. These are the services that you all are responsible for prioritizing and allocating on an annual basis. I've already kind of talked about this, but you know, the issues come to me in a variety of ways. It could be an access issue where a client's disability is not being accommodated or needs to be accommodated, and a new strategy needs to be presented in order to allow the client to appropriately access the services. It could be an eligibility issue. I have supported folks with obtaining documentation for their ID. Sometimes their ID doesn't match what their name is, and we know that you need to have an ID for Rhino Care Funding Service. So that's something that I can always support on to deal with vital records departments. There might be a conflict, which is when I do, you know, employ my mediation services. Sometimes the client just needs some information. If it's a new diagnosis and they don't know the service area, or if they're new to the EMA and they're not familiar with the services that they're eligible for as a result of their status. And then sometimes there's a legal issue that can be supported by, you know, the other attorneys in my office. And when that happens, I have a great team of folks that I can rely on. So I'll talk just a little bit about the consumers that I serve first. I'll share not a whole lot of remarkable outliers. And I also just want to, you know, be careful of thinking of things like this as a trend. It's a very small sample size, right? I saw 101 unduplicated clients this year, who presented 128 HPAP matters. There are folks that come with multiple matters. In fact, I think this year it was 18. I have a slide later on that. The large majority, all here in San Francisco, although I did have three clients in San Mateo and one in Marin this year. Okay, age. So I thought, you know, in the full report, you'll see a more exact breakdown of the age at intake for my clients. Really what I wanted to highlight in this is, you know, obviously 23 of my clients are over 60, but that the bulk of the clients sit in that range between 50 and 60. Their lives are going to change pretty drastically in the next, you know, 10 years at, you know, or maximum of 10 years when it comes to their public benefits or their Medi-Cal eligibility. Things like that are going to change for them. And I wanted to lift this up because I know that there's been an effort by this committee as well as the Department of Public Health to, cooperate a little bit more with the Department of Disability and Aging Services. And, you know, to me, it is entirely foreseeable that this is a population of folks that are going to need those services in a very near point in time. So I just want to, you know, emphasize that I think that partnership is an important one. I think that they can do better, you know, the Department of Disability and Aging Services can do better at supporting folks living with HIV. And here's the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. Gender, not a whole lot of remarkable outliers, although I thought it was interesting. I have seen a slow progression of the number of people identifying as non-binary. I don't have anything to say about that, but it's an interesting point. Again, no other remarkable outliers except for income. And I had 20 people reporting no income this year. And I'm not entirely sure, you know, why that is. I would have assumed that it had something to do with like public charge and folks getting not being able to access public benefits as a result of undesirable immigration status. That's not my word. That's their word. It's obviously impacting folks' ability to obtain a basic income. So top service categories, no surprise, housing services is a number one service category. After that, ambulatory and outpatient medical service, primary care basically, and then dental services. Obviously, these are all core provider, core service categories, so not very surprising. So top issues. I think you all know that information referral tends to be the top category for me. Oftentimes, those referrals, it's not as though I'm like taking folks, and sending them somewhere. Oftentimes, it's within the context of another issue or another matter that I have, which is why folks have multiple issues at a time. But in the course of talking about somebody's conflict or access issue, it may become evident that any other services, the big one in this last contract year was food. And I had so many clients talking to me about stuff that said they don't have access to food or they were experiencing food insecurity. Access 17 cases dealing with access and quality of care cases, there were 14. So here's a little bit of a breakdown I wanted to share. This is part of the report that I provide to the community engagement committee on a monthly basis, but you'll see, I know that there was interest in understanding a little bit more, when you see, I saw JP and he was like, I just make sure I see one on there. If it's not a conflict, it's just a referral, I'm happy, When I do this, I try to share, there may be 20 cases, only 6 of them are referrals for ambulatory outpatient services. For housing services, double the number of cases than there are for referrals. Others, there are, it's pretty common for me to almost all of the referrals, for food are referrals. All the cases that I see for food are referrals. Again, that's a common one that I see in the, during the conversation, during the intake, during consultation. So 9 terminations and suspensions of services this year. With my advocacy, so the terminology is a little odd, which I'm gonna consider changing that for next year. Folks, I'll consult with DBH on it, but it is a little confusing. So of this, 5 of the agency's initial actions were rejected. We were successful in overturning suspension or termination 5 of those 9 times. And in 4 instances, the service provider was unwilling to change their decision. We filed 11 grievances as opposed to 15 in the previous year. I think that indicates that folks are utilizing services for in a non-adversarial way a little bit more this year. I've talked about this before. I have some clients that come to me year after year. I have some clients that come to me repeatedly throughout the year. One example, I have a client who I have no reason to see them on a regular basis, but they come and they drop off a copy of their rent receipt to me every at the beginning of the month. Great, I love that. I get to see them. I get to see what's going on. There are issues that I wouldn't hear about otherwise unless I saw them on a monthly basis. So these repeat consumers, I think, and this is a client who would have a lot of trouble accessing services if they didn't, speak to me on a regular basis. So I think that in and of itself, is a success. And then I know that there was a request by the council to understand a little bit more about how many people are we seeing? And so to address that, Jordan ran some numbers for me. we had 18 clients with more than one issue this year. So that's folks who came to HCAP for more than one issue in the contract cycle, and 15 clients who returned from the previous cycle. So kind of an interesting bit of data, but that makes sense. About 15% of my client base. I think that's pretty good for any attorney to see them year after year. I want to talk just a little bit about some outcomes that we had. This is I thought this case was good to highlight because this client actually had some very complex legal concerns. They came to AORP with, it was a family law matter that had progressed and turned into you know, there was a restraining order involved. None of these issues would not be better served by having some showing of substance use services, right? That's how you want to walk into a judge in a restraining order hearing and say, hey, I'm addressing some of, you know, these behavioral issues, right? Now, I would not have urged the client to do that if they hadn't expressed an interest in doing that. I would have shared this important information. But they went, we first got them connected, so there was a referral there. And then I followed with this client through the process. They completed their program, and then when they left, they needed some more documentation for the court. I was able to reach out to the service provider and make sure that the client got that information, and also made sure that they knew they were eligible for further support if they decided to go back to a longer program. So started out as a referral, wound up being a more longitudinal relationship. This is another complicated case. This is a client that had a very complicated mental health, physical health issues. They came to me thinking that they were suspended from a service. When I spoke with the client, or when I spoke with the service provider, I said, well, yes, there were some behavioral issues, some disruptive behavior. We could see them again, but we're not going to be able to give them what they need. This is not a clinic for them because they need a more intensive psychiatric support than what we can offer. So, okay, so now we turn to where is the appropriate, you know, where is an appropriate place? Fortunately, we have some low barrier access, you know, clinics here in the city. I've walked with them to the clinic, supported them through a lot of their behaviors, sat with them during their initial consultation, waited with them, even though they wanted to leave many times, to wait until they saw a physician. And within a week, they were connected to psychiatric services, primary care. Unfortunately, the client's behaviors really did not improve, and the client wound up falling out of care again. They were terminated. I advocated the behaviors were just a little too disruptive for the clinic to manage at that time. Obviously, that's the type of thing. If the client comes back, I'm always happy to address it again. I'll go back and say, hey, it's been 6 months. We're in a different place now. What, you know, is there some other option? I'm always happy to try and get it. I am a person who wants folks to be able to get back into care if they are able to access it appropriately. But also, this is a case that kind of reflects a number of different outcomes. So dental services, and I know we had a little bit more of a robust conversation about this at the community engagement level. So at a client that was, there's another dental services discussion to be had after this. So I had, just to kind of show the process a little bit, I had a client that was terminated from dental services due to missed appointments, anxiety, and disruptive behavior. The behavior was that they had such anxiety around having their mouth touched and around dentists that involuntarily they were reacting and pushing the doctors out of the way, which when you have somebody next to your mouth with like sharp objects, not a really safe thing to be doing. And so we had to kind of come up with a solution. That included getting the client some primary care support to obtain medication that would help them access the care appropriately. Client was not connected to ambulatory outpatient care at that time. So that was the first step, right? So to get the client to a point of a dental, you know, dental services and get that termination overcome, it requires some effort to get the client connected to primary care. But we did that. Client's mouth is, you know, it became a little bit more urgent after the client had an injury to their mouth. But as far as I know, they are accessing dental care appropriately now. This is a situation here where there was a client that went to very painful and you know, kind of dangerous open wound in their mouth. They were terminated from services. And the client called me. The report was that the clinic had asked them for a recent lab report of their you know, their viral count. And that's what the client heard as the termination, the reason for termination. In fact, that wasn't the reason for the termination. The reason was that there were some behavioral issues that were incredibly disruptive and jarred one of the staff members to the point where they couldn't provide services anymore. So I did make sure to confirm that it wasn't an issue with their HID status. I will always push back against that with the provider. I don't think that's nobody has ever asked me for my pronoun at this office since I've been positive. So I think that some of the providers operate under a teaching model. So I understand having some standards of care, but private practice, they don't do that. So I will always confirm that it's not an HIV-related termination, but there are certainly reasons why, from a patient perspective, you would want to ask that question for a client. Some ongoing challenges. The population is aging. As I said, I think, from an advocacy perspective, we're trying to take steps to loop in other, services, other providers from other systems of care, like the Department of Disability and Aging Services. Consistently a number of folks experiencing isolation and isolation from the community. I have some thoughts on intergenerational projects. I'm hoping that we get a volunteer in the fall to kind of work through that. I think it would be an interesting project to kind of support long-term survivors in expressing their artistic knowledge. Obviously I'll keep you all posted on that. Obviously there's some additional health issues as folks age. There are some complications, needing geriatric care. One that I actually saw in a couple of, and it's not, they don't count as age cap cases because I was providing services around their estate plan. But one thing that showed up twice this year was folks who are experiencing dementia from Burkhan, which HIV AIDS neurocognitive disorder. So I don't know what the acronym stands for. I go to med school. What's that?
That's pretty close.
Yes. Obviously, something like that requires more eyes on it when it comes to drafting incredibly powerful documents like a power of attorney that gives somebody the right to go to a bank account and empty it out. So there's some checks that we have in place in the law. They're not foolproof, but there are ways that we can support to kind of make sure that folks can get those really critical documents done. Hopefully before they reach any kind of challenges with their capacity. We just document, we get, we loop in providers. So I guess we're about to see more of that coming up. Obviously a lack of in-home support services. This is coming up on a regular basis, and I feel like I've been saying it for 6 years, but there are, folks who can't, their needs are too, their needs are too high for them to live independently without support, but not enough to require institutionalization or to meet the Medi-Cal definitions to receive services in a skilled nursing facility or otherwise. And we haven't, I don't think, in the system of care effectively closed the loop on that or connected the dots so that folks can have the supportive services that they need in the meaningful way that they do. It kind of has a one size fits all approach to it, and that's just simply not true. And then obviously mental health issues continue to affect everybody, but people living with HIV. So clients experiencing an overwhelming sense of powerlessness and injustice. I think that's a very common thing for a lot of folks. A lot of that has to do with the fact that health inequities are mirrored by the justice system. And, there's a lot of folks who feel like they don't have any recourse. Right. So where do I go? They just get away with this. That's a very common thing. In some instances, yes, right. But we can. I try to empower folks through the grievance process to at least voice their concern. And I'll share I had a client who, you know, they were done to, they didn't want to see the service provider anymore. I don't want to walk away without them knowing how I felt. I'm happy to file a grievance on that, right? To try and make sure that it's, you know, their kind of dissatisfaction is communicated in a professional way. Like the relationship is over, so there's no loss, right, to the client to, you know, to ruin, you know, to end that relationship. But I think it's that the grievance process supports not only a consumer, but it also helps us within the system of care to know that, hey, something's happening that was bad enough that this person doesn't want to come to your office anymore. I don't know if that's a unique situation, but if it isn't, maybe it's something that we can talk about. And then obviously federal policies that are affecting folks in especially multiply marginalized communities. The Medi-Cal asset limit is going to be just deadly, really. I'm particularly concerned about how that's going to affect folks' access to dental services as well, because there's a lot of folks who rely on Dentical for services that I'm not sure the providers are able to weather that. So in short, we've been successful at repairing consumer provider relationship to the tune of 55%. I think more than that, we talked about, informal, not exact terminations or suspensions. We've, certainly strengthened relationships, maintained therapeutic relationships with folks. Consumers were twice as likely to file form agreements this year, but obviously, like I said, that can result in helpful changes to the community and to the clients. And then consumers struggling to meet their basic needs. And I guess that's what HCAP is there for, is to help them meet those things. So thank you. So I'm happy to answer any questions you folks have. Yeah, so
cool. First, I love the therapy that you guys have done for so many people. The question goes like this: it's very important, and it goes with the statement, to recognize also when there's trouble clients and still think about mental health, but also when the agencies help, right? So in my case, about 10 years ago, I went to the dental school, and that's what the question was to. 6 months passed by, they were supposed to do a bridge. A year passed by, the bridge was not there. A year and a half, 2 years. So I was outside of the clinic with a little sign, give me back my teeth. Then you guys go up and you guys the arbitration. And they got together, the clinic and myself. And what happened then was that they said, you have to give things you speak, but that was already a year and a half. When that moment happens and you guys start doing that arbitration, besides doing some kind of arrangement like that, are there any other options for the client? Because even the director of the school, she was trying to let me go outside of the school, but even the guard said, no, you have the right to be outside as soon as you don't enter the school. And because even the students were joking, like you couldn't be studying in the school and be your own team. So what is the option when you get to that point of arbitration and the client is not a trouble client, but just waiting for something to happen?
Yeah. So obviously it's going to depend on every case. The reason is because the client's goal is what I'm there to effectuate, right? The client chooses the goal and the attorney chooses the strategy. That's how it goes. There's unfortunately, this is why HCAP exists, right? Sometimes despite whatever injustice, righteous or not, is being experienced, there are not other options. Oral health in particular is one that is very tricky. There's very few service providers. I have clients who have effectively burned out all of the providers with either behaviors or frustration, whatever it was. And I realize that's not what you're asking about. but I am sometimes in the very unfortunate position of telling my client, I know, I hear what you're saying, but here's what we're gonna do. You want your teeth? Let's write an apology letter, and then the client will yell at me, why should I have to apologize, right? And I'd say, yes, I know. but here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna write an apology letter, right? And sometimes if that's what the goal is, it may take somebody like me to have that unfortunate conversation. And I realize that it feels oppressive. I realize that it feels unfair, unjust, all of those things. But we are simply not going to find an attorney who is going to sue, right? And especially with issues like that, dentures, things like that. We're talking about a small claims court case, right? And so you can't even have a lawyer in small claims court. So if the amount in controversy is under $12,500, you're on your own. So, you know, you can consult with an attorney ahead of time, but I'm not going to be there to represent you. I can kick me out. And so, you know, and that's not my methodology anyway, but, I'm not saying that I'm not going to advocate for the client, but if the goal is to simply get something done, it's either going to be a referral to an alternative service provider. And if that doesn't exist, we're just going to have to play nice. Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, that's just how it is. I don't have a solution. I can say this, we have more options for oral health here in San Francisco than many other jurisdictions. There are jurisdictions that don't have any oral health providers.
Any questions?
I just wanted to note that this is my work process and stuff, but in your you're looking at various kinds of projects, and you mentioned one each, or then if you can fail. And I'm wondering if some of that is I'm wondering if the board members is awareness. Just the sort of your ability, because you're like a one person, one in a sort of program, like it just the plain sort of outreach, like what will you accomplish?
Yeah, well, so I will say this, when I do outreach is I get clients, like that happens in both jurisdictions. I will say that, you know, I had one HAP client in Marin, but we saw many clients actually. I was up there, we did a whole estate planning workshop. We had, I don't know, something like 27 clients that day. I don't know how many people exactly showed up, but we did a bunch of wills and stuff. So we, you know, we see clients in AORP, like I said, AORP services are broader than what HCAP can provide, and also broader than what the HCAP service area. So some of it is outreach. I've always, in fact, I'll be in San Jose tomorrow to go to their community meeting. So I'm always trying, but yeah.
Is there, has there been anything you look at for how to replicate this program in places?
I don't know.
Or any interest?
Well, that was my hope, was to, you know, go to the Ryan McCare conference, and like I said, I had some great feedback, some great support and encouragement from VDH, and, you know, to do that. I would have liked the opportunity to talk about the program in VMA. Dr. Gandhi's going to be there, actually, so the VMA will have some representation at the conference, but I would have liked to talk about the program and evangelize it a little bit, to be honest. I think it works. I think it's effective.
Great. Any other questions? Anybody from the public? Beth?
I'm not sure I have to answer a question about the public. I would be interested to know later about the difficulty of basic needs with your skiller, whether it was always working at your perspective with like medical based management or system providers, or whether there was a lack of access or was just not 100% integrated to have that.
Yeah, like I said, especially that one is something that I learned in the course of the consultation. they may have known the provider or have, oh yeah, you know, oh, I've used that service before, like a bunch of years ago, the last time that they were experiencing it, right? But forgot that they were eligible. So that is something that, you know, anecdotally comes up. I can dig a little deeper if there's something, you know, by the department to know more about what's leading to that. I can, at best, probably hypothesize, but I'm happy to look at the data and see.
Thank you very much. How about this works?
Not saying, I just want to thank you personally from the standpoint of the work that you do and show up being consistent, right? Your way of presenting information very accessible and kind of a story kind of selling services. Derek, I think a little bit to answer your question, this is a preventative measure. So I feel like you weren't in this role doing this particular work and the council was not supportive of this, that we would get consumers that would not get resolution and
going
to us
much
more frequently. And so I just kind of acknowledge that preventative. And the absence of angry consumers in our space is much to do with the services that are being provided to the unit.
I would like to.
So thank you for that. And I appreciate you also bringing a personal story at appropriate times. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. A lot of evaluation. It's difficult. That would be great. See you all the various committees and space. And I'm going to.
Thank you.